It's downstairs in the basement, way underground, next to a lot of plumbing. And every time somebody in the building flushed, I stopped. So we've gone a long way. Well, it was a hazard. No doubt about that. We are going this year to study the tractate of Kiddushin. Kiddushin is one of the tractates of the Talmud. We read the Babylonian Talmud. I'll tell you just a little bit about that in a general introduction in a moment. And what I recommend is that you purchase the edition, which is the Art Scroll edition of the Babylonian Talmud. And you can see it there behind Ellen. It's a multi-volume work. It's about 50 volumes. But just this one volume is what we'll be using. Tractate Kiddushin for the first volume of Kiddushin. We'll be doing chapter 1. So it's the first that's indicated on the art scroll by one star. That's where our art scroll indicates volumes 1, 2, 3, whatever it is, and the stars. There's one star on this. I happen to have the small edition. The art scroll Talmud exists in a few different forms. The main forms are that one that you see on the wall. Those are the large volumes. And this one is the small volume. The difference in cost is not very great, but it's a little bit more expensive than this is. The value of this, from my perspective, is that it's easier to carry. The value of that is that it's easier to read. So, you know which of those values is greater to you. So we will be studying the first chapter. The first chapter deals with several different subjects. Firstly, with the basic concept behind the Jewish wedding ceremony.
I can hear.
Basic concept behind the Jewish wedding ceremony, number one. Number two, it moves from there to discuss general issues of acquisition in Jewish law. Then the Masechet is the classical source of the laws of Kibud Av Ve'Em, honoring one's father and one's mother. It proceeds from those laws to the laws of honoring the old, place of the elderly in the society. And from there, the tractate has a major section on the obligations of women according to Jewish law. What women are obligated and where women are free from obligation. So it's a rich chapter with a variety of subjects that most of which really are of real interest to us. The more abstruse being some of the economic things that we'll look at, but this is also interesting. Particularly for you lawyers, I think that you'll find that interesting, but in general, I find the economic material in the Talmud is quite interesting because you see the structure of society and the way in which frequently ethics impinges upon the economic realm. So that is the first chapter of Kiddushin that we will be reading. The way we read is that we go over it in class. If you can go over beforehand or review what we did in the previous class, that enriches, I think, the level of study. And we come and we discuss the material. And we will talk about it. It is in the original, and it is in English. The value of this edition of the Talmud is that it has a first-rate English translation. It has excellent English notes. And therefore, you can really read the Talmud just in English, reading it in the Art Scroll edition. That has never been possible before, ever. It's never been possible before to read the Talmud in any language, without many commentaries. I think the Talmud is easier to have access to today than it ever has been before, because of the Art Scroll translation. Pascal translation is now done originally in English. Now it's being done in Hebrew. Most of the volumes are out already in Hebrew. The Israelis are using it. And it also is now in French. So it has been a major, major publishing venture in the Jewish community, and has been a very successful venture in every way. So that's the subject, that's the book. You can get the book, I would recommend it a few different places. You can get it across the street in Sellers, which is now called something like Mazel Brocha. You can get it on the west side, in West Side Judaica. They're going out of business? No, that's why I'm sending you this, so they won't go out of business. I'm working for them. I'm working to have Jewish bookstores in the neighborhood. And therefore, I think it's good to patronize the stores. Now, what that Judaica says, and I'm sure they're right, since the rents are going up and people know that they can buy the books on the internet, and the people who are selling them on the internet don't have to pay the rent on Broadway or on Lexington Avenue, so that they can charge a somewhat lesser price. And all that is true. It's the economic reality of the thing. And one of the results will be that there'll be no more Jewish bookstores in our city. And I don't think that's good for the Jews. So I really recommend patronizing the stores. It costs a little bit more money, not a lot more. It's a little bit more inconvenient, not a lot more. But I think that we have something to gain as a community as a result. And it is true that you can purchase all of this on the internet also. Okay? Any questions about what we're doing? What the book is? No? Okay. Yes.
Probably also Workman's Circle and Levine's.
Oh, Levine surely does. If you work in Midtown, always had, I think it's going to change names now, on 45th Street with Eichler's. And it's still called Eichler's? Still called Eichler's? I hope so. It's an excellent store, very good. Well located for those of you who are working in Midtown, and they'll have all of these things. And generally speaking, if you have a whole crowd of people who are looking for one volume of Kiddushin, truth is it'll sell out quickly. So what you have to do is just order it. And I've got to say, easy enough. It'll take them a short time. The books are printed, I think, in Brooklyn. So it's not hard to resupply. Okay? Anybody else? Now, just a few words. I want, since there are a number of you who are new to the class, I want to say a few words about what the Talmud is. But as a matter of fact, before we do that, why don't we go around the table and introduce yourselves. And if you have anything in particular you want to say about studying the Talmud or why you've come or anything like that, or even not like that, feel free to do. I think you know who I am. I'm Harlan Rechstein, and I have the pleasure and privilege of being the Rambam Congregation or his own. To my left is...
Fornia.
Very good.
Took me a minute or two.
I know, you're into the Talmud already. You want to dispense with formality. That's okay.
Wasn't an easy question.
Depends on how you answer. Ari Weiss.
Michelle
Trachtenberg, good. Peter Shilagi. And he's waiting for the Hungarian translation of the article. What is that? Part of it, all right? That's good.
Carol Rapper.
Robert Olden.
Okay, come on.
Bobby Kohler.
Jay Palmer.
Nora Yurt. Barry Yurt.
Gail Billig.
Mark Lawrence.
Francis Friedman.
Jeffrey Lamarcus.
Iowa Glauber.
Robert Feller.
It's a pleasure. Nice to say hello to all of you again. Gail and Mark were married this summer. Mazel tov to you. It's a pleasure to have you here. First year of married life. Hatam and Tamba. Nice to have you with us. Now, What is the Talmud? Talmud that we will be studying is the oral law of the Jews. The Jews have a written law, the Parasha Bechtav, and that you can find in the Holy Ark, in this synagogue, and in any synagogue. Once there is a written law, it is our tradition that there is a tradition of explanation of the written law. That will always be true. In any system of written law, there has to be an explanation of that law. For example, when the Torah says, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes, who is to say what that means? Do you know whether that is a metaphor? Whether it is a way of saying that you shall put these things close to your mind and your heart? Or does it mean that you should put boxes on your head? Frankly, I would think it was probably metaphoric if I didn't have the benefit of the oral law, which says, no, there are boxes called the tefillin. And then the Shema says, Ukshatam ota yadecha v'ayulatotafon b'nenecha. We know what it means. It means you take these boxes, you wrap them around yourself, the four portions of the Torah are put in, all that. How do you know that? Because you know the oral law, the Parasha Ba'alteh. So we have a written law and we have an oral law. The oral law contains a lot of different things. As I just demonstrated to you, some of the things that are in the oral law are understood within the context of that law to go back as far as Moses on Mount Sinai. So that the original explanation of you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes is tefillin. Because that's what the oral law says it is. But then again, exactly the shape of the box, how big it can be, whether it has four compartments, three compartments, two compartments, all those details, you have to look into the oral law. Now, in any system of law, the system of law has a beginning. If it functions as a system of law, it probably has no end. However, between the beginning and the end is a middle, which is the history of that law. That law as it functions in a society where it's alive. Any legal system, any system that dates from a Torah like ours, which is approximately 3,300 years old, according to our own tradition, any system that old will also accrue interpretations over time. New issues will arise. Those issues will be resolved, sometimes on the basis of previous decisions, sometimes on the basis of citing the written law, sometimes on the basis of citing the oral law. Where would you go to find the history of that interpretation? To the Parasha Bata. Because the oral law contains in it several different layers of things. Some things that are understood within the context of that law itself to go back to Moses on Mount Sinai. Other things within that law are really the development of what happened at that earlier stage. There are discussions. Discussions between Rabbi so-and-so and Rabbi so-and-so trying to resolve an issue. Sometimes that issue is resolving a tradition. Sometimes it is producing a tradition. All of that is in the oral law. Where do you find the oral law? Basically, you find it over there. It's in the Talmud. That's what the Talmud is. Talmud came into being in late Roman times in order to be able to preserve something that in a political reality was in danger of being lost. Because since it was an oral tradition, it was in fact not only customary but obligatory to keep it oral and not write it down. Because of the vicissitudes of life under the Romans, the rabbis realized that that just wasn't going to work. And therefore the oral law was written down. It was written down in two stages, basically. One stage, at the end of the 2nd century, roughly the year 200 CE, by Rabbi Judah the Prince in the land of Israel, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He was one of a long line of rabbis in a rabbinic tradition, and he had the clout, both politically and intellectually, to be able to produce a certain corpus of the oral law as it existed to his time, and to set that down, or at least to decide what was going to be a basic part of that corpus, and that was called the Mishnah. Memshin Nun Hei in Hebrew. Mishnah. M-I-S-H-N-A-H. That was in the year 200. There were a lot of discussions that he left out of his edition of the Mishnah, because the law had already existed now for 1,500 years prior to that. Well, immediately after Rabbi Judah the Prince set down the Mishnah in the year 200 CE, the rabbis wanted to know what he meant when he set this thing down, because that's the nature of a written text. As soon as you put it down, as soon as you frame it, as soon as you publish it, nobody understands it. Because people say, well, what does he mean by this? The language is strange. Was he carrying a tradition? Ah, somebody else says, not too long thereafter, oh yes, I remember there was another tradition that will clarify this. He shortened the language, or he had a form of that tradition which was a little bit obtuse or oblique. And therefore, if you see the larger one, something that was contemporaneous with that Mishnah, but left out of the Mishnah, you'll understand the Mishnah. Where do you go to find those things? The Talmud. Talmud. Right after the publication, as it were, of the Mishnah in the year 200 CE, whatever that means. There were no printing presses, of course. And my teacher, the late professor Shaul Lieberman, said that the publication of the Mishnah meant not publication the way we think of it, but in fact a decision made about what fits in the corpus and what is outside the corpus. It was an editorial decision in a world where there really weren't many books. But it was a significant editorial decision. And keep in mind that a pre-modern society is also an oral society, with rare exceptions, and that exception tends to be the written law, the Perashat Bichtav. Basically, people in pre-modern societies had greater trust for those who carried down the oral tradition than for those who had written traditions. We're the opposite. We figure if it's an oral tradition, it must have gotten messed up along the way. Generally, in the pre-modern world, it's the opposite. The people who are respected are the people who are the storytellers, the people who have the best memories, the people who you can trust are the people who bear the tradition and whom the community recognizes as the valid transmitters of the tradition. Anybody who would write it down, writing something down, is subject to changing a letter, changing a word, having another edition, making a mistake. But a great figure who remembers things is like nothing else. That's in the oral world. Right after the time of Rabbi Judah the Prince, then, those things that were left out of the Mishnah, which were called baraitot. Baraita is a singular, the plural is a baraitot. You'll see them, the art scroll uses the Ashkenazi pronunciation of Hebrew, so they call it a Baraita and Baraitas. I'm using the Sephardi pronunciation of Baraita and Baraitot. Barla in Aramaic means outside. Outside. So Baraitot are outside of the Mishnah. They're contemporaneous with the Mishnah, that is to say roughly from the year 0 to 200 CE. Roughly from 0 to 200 CE, but they were not included in the Mishnah. We have collections of Baraitot in a few different places. The main one is in the Gemara. The Gemara is part 2 of the Talmud. The Talmud is part 1 is Mishnah, part 2 is Gemara. The Gemara is what edited roughly the year 500 CE. Was edited in Babylonia, the Gemara that we are using, although there was a Gemara also produced in the land of Israel, edited about 100 years before that. never achieved the popularity of the Babylonian Talmud for a lot of political reasons, having to do with the nature of the early Arab Empire. But the Gemara itself contains first Baraita, secondly, discussions of issues relating to the Mishnah, thirdly, new issues as they arose. Not only does it contain law, but it contains lore, L-O-R-E. It contains stories, and it contains detailed discussions and arguments about law. It's really a combination of the two. And in any masechet, you never know when you're going to run into what's called the Agadah, the Agadah in Aramaic, Agadah, the legend or lore parts, or the Halakha, the legal part. Halakha is Jewish law. Haggadah is Jewish lore. Hello, Ari. Okay? So, when Rabbi Judah the Prince published the Mishnah, he published it in five sections. In those days, when you would publish a book, he called it six orders. Each one was called an order. In Hebrew, you know the word for order. No matter how much Hebrew you know, because you know it's Seder. And therefore, the Mishnah was called the Shisha Sidarim, the six orders of the Mishnah. That initial, Shin for Shisha, Samach for Sidarim, those two letters came to be used together as a contraction, pronounced Shas, and Shas is the Talmud. It came up a political party. The reason they named it Shas was because everybody in the know knew that it was a cool idea, that they could name it whatever, for whatever practical reason it was, but Shas meant the Talmud. So when we use the term Talmud, or Shas in Hebrew, okay, or Talmud in Hebrew. Talmud is also in Hebrew. Talmud refers to the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Mishnah to the year 200, the Gemara sort of commentaries on the Mishnah. So divided into six orders. Those orders really cover the whole gamut of Jewish law. The whole gamut of Jewish law. The first order is Zeraim. Zeraim literally means seed. That covers the entire area of agricultural law as it pertains to the land of Israel. And to some extent, agricultural law may pertain outside the land of Israel, mostly in the land of Israel. Right now, for example, we're in a Shemitah year. Shemitah year means that this is a sabbatical year. It is prohibited for a Jewish farmer to grow the crops of the soil that he owns in the land of Israel. It's prohibited. Fascinating subject. Any of you who are read the Jewish press, by the small piece of press on any regular basis, have read articles over the last few weeks on the political issues that are sort of percolating and bubbling now in Israel about the Shemitah. Where do you go to find the laws of Shemitah? You go to Zeraim, the first of the orders, the first of the Sidarim, first Seder of the Talmud. One of the tractates is the Alphabet called Shvi'it, the seventh year. The second order is Moed. Moed is like Chol HaMoed, or Good Moed. Moed is the festivals of the year. Okay, so all of the discussions of all of the facts from the Sabbath to Pesach to Chol HaMoed, to you name it. It's all in the order of Moed. The third order is called Nashim. Women. And that is an order that deals with all of the law that relates to women. Okay? And some of the law is just obliquely or tangentially related to women. Such as well, the first of the orders, the first of the tractates in the order of Nashim is Yevamot, Yevamot, dealing with the levirate marriage. You'll actually talk about that as a result of the first piece of the Soma. What levirate marriage is. So that's when a man dies, has no children, and he dies and has no children, but he has brothers. His widow is required to marry one of his brothers. Modern perspective is a very odd law. Matter of fact, the modern world is also against Jewish law to do that, but the Torah requires it. That's a very interesting area of law, but it's a large tractate. Generally speaking, the way the orders are arranged, they're arranged, you have a Seder, and then it has Masechtot. A Masechet is a tractate. So you have the Seder of Nashim, the first Masechet, first tractate, is Yevamot. In most cases, the way the tractates are ordered in the Seder is by size. So Yevamot is the biggest, that comes first. The second one is Ketubot. If you were married according to Jewish law, you had a Ketubot as part of your wedding ceremony. So that is the second of the tractates in Nashim. One of the smaller tractates in Nashim is Kiddushim, the one we are going to study, which deals specifically with issues relating to a marriage ceremony. And the fact that I said to you before, laws that pertain to women, when women are obligated, when women are not obligated, difference between the law that is obligatory to men as opposed to women, you would now understand why that's in Kiddushim. Because that's a whole area of law that tends to have in it centrally laws that relate to women. The fourth order of the six orders of the Mishnah is Nizikim. Those are all the laws of damages. There you have the civil law, the criminal law of torts. Okay, that is, we studied here a few years ago, Baba Kama, which was Shosh and Nagach Papala, when an ox gores a cow. Okay, so all of those basic laws of damages are now in the fourth Seder, fourth order, which is Nizikim, literally meaning damages. The fifth order is Kuf, is the letter, Kodoshim, all the laws of sacrifice. And all the laws, so remember that some of the book of Exodus, a good part of the book of Leviticus, and a good piece of the book of Numbers is about sacrifice. Right, wide variety of laws about sacrifice, also in Deuteronomy. And those laws are all in the fifth order of Kodoshim. Kodoshim means holy offerings. Holy offerings. There, by the way, that you have the laws of Kashrut. Some of you who have heard me talk about the laws of Kashrut know that the laws of Kashrut really come out of the sacrificial laws. They grow out of the sacrificial laws, and that eventually they are the laws of Kashrut, when they're first mentioned in the book of Leviticus, are really mentioned as part of sacrifice. They are mentioned as part of the laws of Tumah and Torah, of purity and impurity in the temple precincts. The sixth order of the Mishnah is Tohorot, which specifically deals with purity and impurity. That too is a wide area, a very complex area of Jewish law, having to do with the temple. The only one of the tractates, I shouldn't say the only one, there are a variety of tractates that have some practical relevance even without the temple. The most common one is the tractate of Nidah, that dealing with menstruation, the laws of Tarat HaMishpacha, of the family purity, which pertain to this day. Those are still laws incumbent upon men and a wife in their sexual relations. All of that is found in Masechet Nidah, which is now part of the, as I said, the sixth order of the Mishnah, the sixth order then of the Talmud, which deals with the laws of purity. Now, the first letters of each of those words that I just told you, each of the six orders of the Mishnah, Zion, Mem, Nun, Kuf, Tet, actually spells two Hebrew words. Zayin Mem Nun Zman Nun Kuf Tet Nakat, which means in good Hebrew and good English, it takes time.
What was it?
It takes time. It takes time. Nakat is to take, and Zman is time. It takes time to study Talmud. Talmud is, as we call it, the Yam HaTalmud. It is the sea of the Talmud. And it is something that if you are so inclined and you have the good fortune and also the mind for it, you usually get to scrape a little bit of the surface of it. Academies of Jewish learning throughout the ages, including and especially in our own time, have developed curricula that are based entirely on the study of Talmud, or 98% on the study of Talmud, and everything else comes secondary to that. The great yeshivas of Lithuania, for example, studied Talmud day and night. That is what was studied. If you were a student of a Russian yeshiva, you study Talmud day and night. I have a friend in Yerushalayim I was speaking with. I was discussing their child's education, whether he should have any secular education, whether he should go through yeshiva, which offered any kind of secular studies. Eventually, because of the nature of the child and the nature of the parents, they decided at this stage of the game, no. So I said, well, how's he going to learn math and geography and, you know, the things that a person should know about? So they said to me, correctly, from studying Talmud. Because the truth is that everything is in the Talmud. Sooner or later, everything is in the Talmud. If you really study Talmud, you won't believe what's in the Talmud. You think something you did today is nonsense, the Talmud, you're wrong. Everything is in the Talmud. Well, language changes slightly. They didn't have electric lights, but you see, after a while, you learn to make those transitions. You realize that everything is there. Every subject you ever thought of, every idea, every college course you ever took, the basis of all of the ideas of the history of the world are all in the Talmud. of course, but that makes it very difficult. Who studies everything? None of us does that. So, on the most basic level, if it were an easy book to understand, it would be difficult. But the truth is, it is an extremely difficult book to understand. It is written in a style with a curtness of language so that, frankly, it's nearly impossible to understand. And Talmud is really just about incomprehensible without commentary. And therefore, you will see any edition of the Talmud is printed with the Talmud in the middle of the page, but we're giving one of those volumes on top of you. That's a traditional Gomer shot. It's just easier to illustrate. They are picking up any volume. The Vilna Shas, this was the Talmud that was set in Vilna before World War II, and became a standard text. And when Talmud production developed in this country, the standard text that we use is the Vilna edition of the Shas. This is the last, we have this one, this is the last Vilna Shas published in New York. There's no longer a Vilna Shas published in New York. All of the Vilna Shas are published in Israel today. And we have the last one that was published in New York. This is done by Grossman, and Grossman was on the Lower East Side. But here, you open up any page, and you see just the physical arrangement of a page of Talmud. Okay? This is the Talmud. It's in the middle of the page. Around it are commentaries, because it's incomprehensible without a commentary. You simply cannot understand it unless you read the commentary. Now, obviously, it's not that easy to read the commentaries. If you take a look at the commentaries, for example, these are more or less Hebrew commentaries. They are printed in the traditional Vilna Shas in a special type of script called a Rashi script. Because Rashi in the traditional Chumash was printed in this type of script. It's a little different from our regular block Hebrew characters. So if you want to read Rashi's script, I could sit in a half hour and show you how to read Rashi's script. It's not hard. But it is a little bit different. So This is the Talmud text. This is the commentary. The great commentaries have been written throughout the years. There are endless commentaries. The Jewish Theological Seminary has a library of commentaries. The Hebrew University in Israel has a library of commentaries. The Vatican Library has a library of commentaries. Endless commentaries have been written in the Talmud. Only a small part of them, by the way, have been published. Many of them are still in manuscript form, and if it's an interest of a scholar, you can get a PhD by publishing a commentary that's something that's been published before. And nobody publishes the whole commentary in the Talmud. You publish a commentary to a Masechet. That'll get you a PhD. When I studied Talmud for the first time, I studied, I'm a student of, not the first time, when I began in the seminary, one of my first teachers was Rabbi Eddie Gershwin. Rabbi Gershwin was a wonderful Talmudist. I grew up in Winnipeg, New York, Winnipeg, Canada, and then went on to Oxford to study the history of law, got his PhD at Oxford, and then Dr. Finkelstein invited him to the seminary. Very slim guy, Rabbi Gershwin, and Gershwin had a good sense of humor, still alive, and he has a good sense of humor. He used to say it as follows. He said, in the old days, in Europe, there used to be professors of Talmud. In the next generation, there will be professors of Kiddushin. One chapter. In your generation, there will be professors of page 2-6. So it was both a put down and an acknowledgement of the reality of Jewish learning. Because if you take this kind of learning, realize that people like myself were the beneficiaries of some of these greats from the Eastern European world. I mentioned to you my teacher before, Shaul Lieberman. Lieberman, who was one of the greatest Talmudists of the 20th century, knew the Talmud by the needle. That means, if you were to take a pin, stick it into that word, he will tell you every word that it will go through in all of those lines. Okay? Today, people with that mind are either making fortunes in, what do you call it? No, it's called
hedge funds.
Hedge funds, right. They're hedge fund money. Or they're in computers. They're figuring out new software so that they can be as rich as Bill Gates. There was a time when people had that mind. What did they do with it? They studied the Talmud, because that's what you do. You know, to be a learned person, you become a learned person. To use the material, that's not for learned people. Even today, learned Talmudists look down on rabbis. Rabbis have to use the material. Real intellectuals never use the material. They just sit and discuss it. And they know, they don't want to get their hands dirty. So this is the text. Now, the major texts of commentary on the Talmud are pretty consistent throughout the volumes. They're not completely consistent because some of these commentaries might be lost over the years. Realize, again, we're dealing with commentaries of almost 2,000 years, and it's certainly 1,500 years from the year 500, which is the end of the settling down of the Gemara. So you know, 1,500 years till now. Till the year 1500, basically, you didn't have a printing press. So you're dealing with manuscripts. Many of these manuscripts have been lost. Some of them are in libraries. People find manuscripts every year. There's a new manuscript that's found somewhere in some library. So, the classic commentaries, though, are Rashi, who lived in France in the 11th century. Okay? 1040 to 1105. Rashi's commentary is a commentary on the inside margin of every page. So if you take this page, the inside margin, and here's the binding. This is Rashi. On this page, it's on the opposite side. This is Rashi. It's always on the side which is next to the binding. And that's just a convention of publishing. So you always find the Rashi on the inside. So he had said it's 10:40 to 11:05 in French. Rashi was a Frenchman through and through. He made his living as a vintner. He lived in Foix, Champagne. He was a great producer of champagne. And to this day, the great source of the growing, the agricultural, the way they grew champagne in the 11th century is Rashi. Because if you read Rashi's commentary to the laws of agriculture, which deal with wine, he brings the knowledge of wine agriculture in the 11th century to his interpretation of the Talmud, which occurred 600 to 800 years before. So if you ever want to study wine in the 11th century, the only way to do it is in Rashi, because there are no French manuscripts about those things. If you want to know how to pronounce French as it was pronounced in the 11th century, any scholar, anywhere in the world, French scholar, bibliothèque, okay? You want to know how French was pronounced in the 11th century? Only one way to do it, that's to read Rashi. Because what Rashi did was to translate Aramaic words, I'll say a word about Aramaic in a moment, he translated Aramaic words frequently into Hebrew and sometimes into French. And he wrote the French with Hebrew letters. As a result of writing it with Hebrew letters, which is such a different phonetic alphabet, we now know how French was pronounced in the 11th century. There's no other way. Hey, you know you're French. There's no way to know, because French is not pronounced the way it looks. Right? French is pronounced only the way you learned how to pronounce it. And it's not. It doesn't go according to the way it's written. It just doesn't work that way. So the only way you know, again, about in the 11th century, is to read Rashi. So that's in Rashi. The generation two after Rashi are called Tosafot. Those are his students. They're on the opposite side of the page. They're over here. Then you can have other rabbis. Let's see, what do we have here? Here, this is nearly all Rashi in the Tosafot. No other major commentaries on this page. But you've got a lot of other things on the Talmud page. You've got other footnotes, and you've got cross-references to where the laws, in fact, are ordered. Because at a later period in time, the laws were ordered, just taken out of the text, and put in some sort of rational order. I should say that to you also. Talmud is, on the one hand, extremely rational. On the other hand, it's irrational within the 11 weeks. It's an oral law system. So frequently the line of reasoning moves almost by stream of consciousness. So you never will be sure where you'll be two pages from now. It may be the same subject, it may be a different subject. That's just the nature of the material. Finally, the language. The Bible is written nearly entirely in Hebrew. Not entirely, because the last books of the Bible, the book of Ezra, the book of Daniel, Daniel is in Aramaic. Ezra has significant portions in Aramaic. Excuse me? It was written in Hebrew. That was in Hebrew. Yep. In Persian. That was written in Hebrew. But we had some small pieces of the Bible were written in Aramaic. Aramaic was the language outside of the land of Israel in the Middle East in that period of time, late biblical times. Aramaic came from Babylonia. Came as a product out of the Akkadian language, Akkadian. And outside of the land of Israel, that was the spoken language. In Babylonia, spoken language was Aramaic. Eventually, by roughly the year zero, it was more or less the spoken language in the land of Israel also. The land of Israel had a real mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic. The New Testament scholars always talk about that because so much of the New Testament, although the New Testament is in Greek, the assumption is that it was really an Aramaic document, because that was a spoken language at the time. The Mishnah, however, was written 94% in Hebrew. Scholars wrote in Hebrew. They probably taught in Hebrew, or a combination of Hebrew and Aramaic. So the Mishnah is mostly Hebrew. In the Gemara, right, sort of commentary on the Mishnah, then 200 to 500. The Gemara contains the Baraitot. They, like the Mishnah, tend to be in Hebrew. But the discussions about the law tend to reflect the actual discussions that happened when people talked. And they spoke Aramaic. And therefore, the language that you have in the Talmud is Aramaic. It is Aramaic. So that's one of the difficulties of studying Talmud, is you also have to know Aramaic. And that's another reason why you have to be so dependent upon the commentaries, because most people don't know Aramaic, even if they know Hebrew. Now, Aramaic is the same relation to Hebrew as Spanish is to French. You know, they're not vastly different, but they're pretty different. You can't necessarily understand one if you understand the other. It's easier to understand the other if you understand one, but you don't necessarily understand if you know one. Okay? Any questions?
Where do we codify the laws from 500 until today?
Okay. In the year, by the year, by the end of the 12th century, there have been a few attempts at codification. A few. There has always been a strain in Jewish life which is contrary to codification. Feeling that once you codify something, you put yourself in the hands of the codifier. And who's to say the codifier understands it right? Maybe somebody else understands it better. Because as you know, when you study Talmud, Talmud is very difficult to understand, number one. Number two, frequently doesn't come to a conclusion. And the codifier will want to come to a conclusion because that's the nature of a code. So it will involve a certain amount of interpretation. There were some attempts in the 10th century to codify. There is a Sefer Mitzvot Katan, Sefer Mitzvot Gadol. Those are early attempts at codification. In North Africa, there were some attempts in the 10th century to codify. Nothing really caught on, though. Nothing really was published in the style of a code that really was useful until the end of the 12th century. Because in 1179, Maimonides published his code of Jewish law. That's the Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah literally means the second Torah. Maimonides felt that if people would read his code, they wouldn't need to read the Talmud because they would know the law. Now, the minute he published it, the Jews of Northern Europe attacked him and destroyed him. And until this day, there are people who won't study Maimonides. Generally, his code has become accepted. Not as the only source, because as soon as he did his source, other people did their sources, and they disagreed with Maimonides and the way he came to his conclusion. So by the time they got to the 16th century, that's now 1179 to 1579, let's say 400 years, there's a tremendous amount of debate and other efforts to create codes, none of which really succeeded. It succeeded partially. There was a code in Spain that succeeded, the Tour. But it never really caught on. It never caught on with the whole Jewish community. Roughly 1550, a new code is tried, that done by Rabbi Yosef Karo, called the Shulchan Aruch. That caught on. That worked. Partly because he was a Sephardi living in Sfat, in northern Israel. No sooner did he publish his Shulchan Aruch, and an Ashkenazi Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who lived in Krakow, published what was called the Mappah. In effect, the Ashkenazi differences with the Sephardi custom. And they published these two things together. Another thing that Rabbi Yosef Karo did was that he didn't come to any independent conclusions about how he derived the law. Maimonides was a genius. Maimonides felt that brains could ascertain the correct law. Rabbi Yosef Karo was a completely different phenomenon. Rabbi Yosef Karo, there were, by his time, three major codes of law. One of them being Maimonides, one the Torah, and the one the Smart. So what Maimonides, what Rabbi Yosef Karo did was that he took a vote. And if two of them said it, the law went according to them. That was successful. Interesting, a political consideration like that produced a more successful code. So that to our day, since roughly 1570, the Shulchan Aruch has become the standard part of Jewish law. That's over there, behind Ron. You know, you're looking in the wrong direction. Come back. Yeah. See those books lying horizontally? Right? They're so big that they keep falling down. That's the Shulchan Aruch. That is the standard code of Jewish law. Of course, the minute that's published, what do you think happens? Number one, some people don't understand why he said what he said. That's got to be interpreted. Number two, somebody says, how could he have ever said that? Somebody else says this. He didn't understand what he was saying. But that happened the minute you publish a book. And so, really, until our day, the code that we tend to use is the one published yesterday. And that tends to also have a great deal to do with who publishes it, who wrote it, where it's been published, who is accepted today more than other people. But the major code was the Shulchan Aruch in the middle of the 15th century. Okay. So, let's turn to the text. If you don't have a text, look on with somebody who does that have a text. See if you can get close. Okay. Now I'm just going to read a very small piece of text and then go into a Bible study with you. Okay? The tractate begins, by the way, if you look at the first page here in the Hebrew, look at the top left hand, a big bet on the top left side. Right? The first page of every tractate of the Talmud is page 2. That's a characteristic way of numbering the Talmud text. You begin with page 2 because there is no beginning. There's no beginning and no end, really. I mean, it's sort of an end. You come to the end of it, but there is no beginning, really. And every page, therefore, starts on page 2 because you're bringing everything that comes before it to page 1. And now we're at the page 2. Okay.
Use selecting the different books and study out of order.
Please.
How do you decide, or why do you decide?
I ask people what they'd like to study, get a sense of where the popular voice is, think of what we've done in the past, try to do something a little bit different so that we can cover a different area of Talmud. And we've never done anything in the area of marital law. And this is, as I covered, a number of subjects I thought would be interesting. The tractate begins with the word Ha'isha, Niknet. The woman is acquired, Bishalosh Drachim, in three ways. Vikona Atzma Bishte Drachim, and she acquires herself in two ways. Niknet Bechesef Bishtar Ubediha. She is acquired through kesef, money, or maybe silver, vishtar, through a document, ubeziya, or through sexual intercourse. Bechesef, when we say kesef, money, Beit Shammai omrim, Beit Shammai says, bedinar, ubeshava dinar. When we mean money, we mean a dinar, which is a lot of money. Whatever it is, a lot of money. Or something equal, something of value of a dinar. Ubeit Hillel omrim, but the school of Hillel says, Difruta uveshavatuta. She is acquired with a coin that is the smallest coin, which is a pruta. So in other words, with the smallest possible amount of money. Okay, pruta v'shabe pruta. Bechama hi pruta. How much is a pruta? Echav mishmona b'isara italki. 1/8 of an Italian isar. Okay? Let's just start on that. Now, I'm sure it's all clear. To just give you a sense of how to approach the material, I'm sure that when you read the first line, Aisha Nitnet, woman is acquired, just the concept to the modern line, what in the world does it mean? Is this a purchase? Women owned? Well, what's going on here? I want to introduce you to, well, an introduction to those of you who have known and tolerated me in the past. I have my notes here. Let's take a break to find my notes. Okay. When you study language, one of the problems of studying Talmud is that we are studying something so out of context that when we read it, we bring our own understanding of words in a context so that we can't help but read this in terms of where we are. That's not a bad thing, it's a natural thing. That also may be useful. Academically, however, I think it's really not correct. I think that really what one has to do when you are reading the Talmud, which especially since it is an oral tradition, is to come to have a certain comfort level with the words themselves, with the way in which words are used and were used, and the history of these words, and the context of the historical use of certain Hebrew terms. And therefore, I think it's very important to even begin when you see the word niknet is acquired, which is to us so difficult. You will see that it is a problem on the first page of the Gemara too. And I think that it's important to go back even into the Bible and to think for a moment about the way in which the Bible speaks about marriage in order to see the earliest layer we have in the development of our own culture, which is a literary culture. By virtue of being a literary culture, we depend upon words, and words have their own life. Therefore, if you look, for example, in the book of Genesis, and you see in Genesis 2:15 to 24, and I put out a few Bibles that I just saw here on the table. If you want to, if you have one near you, just take a look at it, but I'm going to read and translate nearly everything. Genesis 2:15 is the story of the creation of woman. Okay? Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam. And the Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to tend it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you are free to eat. But as for the tree of knowledge of good and bad, you must not eat of it, for as soon as you eat of it, you shall die. The Lord God said, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make a fitting helper for him. Okay? And the Lord God formed out of the earth all the wild beasts and all the birds of the sky, and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that would be its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the sky and to the wild beasts. But for Adam no fitting helper was found. So the Lord God cast a deep slumber upon the man. And while he slept, right, I'm going to go into Hebrew. Verse 20. God cast a deep slumber upon the man. Vayishan. And he slept. Vayikach. Achat mitzalotav, and he took one of his ribs. begin with. I want you to be sensitive to the fact that the principal word in describing the creation of woman is vayikach. Now, any of you who know Hebrew know that in Hebrew terminology, what is lakach
used?
What? To take. But what is a lakach? A customer. Because lakach means also to purchase. In classical Hebrew, lakach means to purchase. Okay? And in modern Hebrew, that can also mean the same thing. Okay? Lakachti masha. It can mean I took it, or it can mean I bought it. It can mean either of those two things. In this context, I think it's clear what it means. It means vayikach means he took. God took. But what I want you to become sensitive to are the repeating words that are used in connection with creation at first. And you'll see where we'll go from there. Alright, so, and God took, Vayikach achad mitzalatah, Vayizgor basatachtana, and he closed the flesh underneath that rib. Vayivan Hashem, and God, and the Lord God built the rib. Asher lakach. Asher lakach. Again, which he took. Mina Adam, from the man, Le'isha, he built it into an Isha, a woman. Vayivieha el ha'adam, and he brought her to the man. Now just think of the activity here. On the one hand, she's created, and that is vayikach, he took. There's a taking that is the first step. The second step here is God brings her. Okay? Is bi'ah, vayivieha, lehavi ota, to bring her. Okay? My thesis is, hope to publish it someday, that if you start here, you see the kernel, the seed of everything that is going to come. Because you see that the language begins with two major verbs. Vayikach v'yavi. Alright, it begins with taking and with bringing. And as you will see, that in fact is the essence of the Jewish wedding ceremony. The Mishnah that we are reading now is Isha Shenikneit. The woman who, and Niknei becomes a synonym in rabbinic Hebrew, as you will see, for lakach, taking. And the wedding ceremony is divided into two parts. One part is vayikach, he took, or he acquired. The second part is called chuppah. And the meaning of chuppah is, he takes her into his chuppah, into his house. Okay? So that even in the story of Genesis, if you look at the language is consistent, I would argue, all the way through to the development later, thousands of years later, in the law itself that we just looked at here for a brief moment in the Talmud. Okay? Proof number one. Alright, Genesis chapter 4. Verse 1, Vaha'adam yada et chave ishto. And the man knew Chava, Eve, his wife. So here you see, first of all, he has a wife. Right? It's not just a man and a woman. But there's a new word here. Isha not only means woman, but it means wife. Right? So he has a wife. Vatahar vatered, and she conceived and gave birth at Cain. She gives birth to Cain. Vatomer, what does she say?
Kamiti.
Kamiti. Kamiti. I have acquired an ish. Kamiti ish et Hashem. I have acquired an ish. The opposite of what our Mishnah says. Our Mishnah says a man acquires a woman. She says, I have acquired a man. right from the language of the Temple.
Not necessarily explicit.
No, no. I'm just showing you that it can, it's used here and there, and here is some of these are the beginnings of the language.
It's not a bad way to get the name.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
The word kana, koneshamai bar, the cloth apparently in the ancient language means also creation.
It means creation, exactly. It means creation. Liknot means creation. Lakach, vayikach also means creation. So that in the classical Hebrew, creation and acquiring in the same sense. It's the same word. It's the same word. They have two parts of an idea that is embedded in language. Okay? 4:17, just still in Genesis 4:17 now. Cain knew his wife. Vayeda Cain et ishto v'tar v'led et chanoch vayed bone ir vayikra shema ir. Well, that's only the son. That's not such a good, here's Cain, but Cain also has a wife. Interestingly enough, at this stage of the game also they only have one wife. A few generations later, as a result of the children of Cain, Lamech has two wives. So things change. But realize also the story in creation is one wife. Right? The wife of Vayikach and Vayivier. Right? Noah. The story we read last week in the Torah. We read about Noah going into the ark with his three sons, and each has a wife. Each has a wife. So you see that the social structure of the culture really begins with the notion of a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, that we have seen that creation is connected to the mastery or the taking of something. Now let's go to 11:29 is the end of last week's parsha. Oh, and Abram and Nahor. Look at the language here. Vayik Eila Toldot. Where is 29? Vayikach Avram and Nahor lehen nashim. That then becomes standard biblical language. And Abram and Nahor took for themselves wives, it says here in English. But taking and purchasing are exactly the same word. Lakach, kana, exactly the same word. So kana means lakach, and lakach means kana. And you see, you will see now that the standard biblical way of saying, and he got married, is vayikachlo, and he took a wife. In English, we never think about this because that makes sense to us in English. He took a wife. That seems like, you know, a way to say it, sort of a classic way to say it. But realize in Hebrew, there are other overtones to it.
If the words mean either taking or purchasing, how do they distinguish?
You can't. There's no way to distinguish.
Or how do they express the two different ends?
Huh? Context. It'll all be context. And you have to learn from context. What you can't do is to say kana means purchasing. And it must mean, there's a whole lot of Jewish literature and anti-Jewish literature written until yesterday, or until 5 minutes ago, that says that the Talmud is a book where men own women. Because it says that he purchased a wife. This is how you purchase her. What I'm trying to show you is that that's not what it's talking about. You're dealing with a language where there is no differentiation between taking and purchasing, except by context. And you wouldn't know it if you lived in English. And he took himself a wife, makes perfect sense in English. In Hebrew, you have to realize, it says two things. It doesn't say one thing. Okay?
But in ancient times, wasn't that what was going on?
No. Why? Well, people have assumed it's because that's how you translate it, that must be what was going on. How do you know that was going on? None of us. A lot of the scholarship is faulty. What I'm trying to do is a literary analysis and show you on the basis of literature that you can't draw those conclusions unless you have other evidence. You can have conclusions, but have to be based on evidence, not on the simplistic translation of language. Okay? Because the language is not simple. The language means more than one thing every single time it's used, and you can only learn from the context. And maybe even from the context, you can't be very sure. Okay? Now, let me just take that. Yes?
Why the inference of money?
Why the inference of money? Good question. I'm not going to answer it yet, because that'll be an issue we'll have to talk about. Talmud will address exactly that question on the first page. Why do we bring in the subject of money? Okay? Because bring in the subject of money. Because that's a real question to us. and as I said, that's the first thing I told them, or the second thing I told them. Okay, the next one I wanted to show you, I'll skip a few of these, where Abram, remember Abram goes to down to visit Pharaoh in Egypt, like this week's Torah reading. There it says, Batukach ha'isha beit Pharaoh. You reading it?
I'm reading it.
All right, good. Batukach. Batukach ha'isha beit Pharaoh. What does it mean? Batukach.
She was taken.
Does it mean that, or does it mean she was bought? Or does it mean that he married her? Maybe Batukach.
Two sentences later that he made her his wife.
He made her his wife. That's exactly right. It says two sentences, Va'ekachota li isha. Va'ekachota li, Pharaoh says, I took her for a wife. So where it says, Va'tukacha isha, it probably means the woman was married to Pharaoh. Right? Again, in good English, probably the way to translate it is, was married. Was married. Okay?
It literally took.
It literally took, but I don't know what took means. Took means married, took means, took means, I don't know, bought, I don't know. Okay, now I'll just skip ahead, 2467, here we're going to finally get a wife for Isaac. Okay, we saw Abraham just got married. And now let's look at Isaac. Remember, Eliezer goes to Abram's family in Haran, finds the wife, Rivka. Okay? And then we see here, okay, Vatomer el Eved Mahi Isha Lazel Lech Pasadali Kratenu. She, Rivka, says to him, who is this man who is in the field coming toward us? Vayomer el Eved in the the servant says, the slave says, Hu Adani, he is my Lord. Vatikach ha'tza'ifatikach. And she took her veil and covered herself. Because Rivka now sees Yitzchak. Yitzchak is out in the field. Vayisapera eved li Yitzchak, kolad varim asher asa. And the servant then told Yitzchak all of the things that he had done. Verse 67. Vayivieha Yitzchak. And Yitzchak brought her. Where did you see that before?
God.
So God brought Eve to and Adam together. Brought Eve to Adam. Now, here Eliezer, same language. Vayivieha Yitzchak ha'ohela. To the tent. What is the center of a Jewish wedding? A chuppah. A chuppah. You bring her into the chuppah. I am arguing that this comes right out of the text. This comes right out of Genesis 24:67. And it reflects Genesis 2. Okay? Vayikach et Rivka. And he took Rivka. Vatehi lo le'isha. And she became his wife. And a wonderful word that now appears next. Vayeeha beha. And he loved her. First appearance of the word love in the Torah. Fantastic idea. Right? He didn't fall in love with her and then get married. He got married and fell in love with her. Right? Incredible idea. Just incredible idea. Okay? Yeah. A few more. I'm racing against the clock, so I want you to see all these verses. No, nothing. You gotta wait for me. Genesis 29:14. This is the next generation. Jacob goes to Laban. Right? Laban is the brother of Rivka, the father of two girls, Rachel and Leah. Okay? So Jacob arrives there, and Rachel had seen him, had given his camels water. Remember the story? She sees him, and she sees the camels water. And they go back, and they tell their father that this guy has come, and he's a kinsman sent by Abraham. And here it says, "Vayehi kishmo Laban et Shema Yaakov." When Laban heard the story about the tale about Yaakov, ben achoto, his sister's son, vayaras likrato, he runs toward him, vayechabeklo, and he hugs him. Vayirasheklo, and he kisses him. Vayidieu el beto, and he brings him to his house. Vayasafer laban, and that's interesting. And he told Laban all these things. Vayomer lo laban, and Laban said to him, Ach atzmi ubisari ata. You are my etzem and my basar. Here it's translated as my bone and my flesh. Where did you ever see that before? In Bereshit. Right? When Adam is, the bone comes out, he says eventually, etzem me atzamai ubasar mi basari. Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Right? Here, the very same language is used by Laban. Right? This is a marriage, where just prior to the marriage here. Then, immediately after, verse 23, Vayehi ba'erev, and it was in the evening, Vayikach et Leah, bito, and he took Leah. Again, marriage. Vayaveh ota, Yaveh, bi'ah, Lahavi, to bring and brought. So marriage is always this context of lakachat and lahavi. God is the first one who takes and brings. Here again, there's a taking and a bringing. It's taking and bringing. These are the classical verbs of the marriage reality. Okay? That's enough proof. Just one final one to take one from left field to prove to you something else, by the way, that interests me as a result of that. In Exodus chapter 6, verse 7, this is a classic verse of why we have four cups of wine on Pesach. Why do we have four cups of wine on Pesach? Remember the reason?
Four verbs
of redemption. Okay? So here it says the four verbs of redemption, chapter 6, verse 7. Chapter 6, verse 7. Here it says, no, it's verse 6. L'chein emor l'bnei Yisrael, ani Hashem, v'hotzeiti etchem mitachat zivlot Mitzrayim. I took you out of the burdens of Egypt. Vehit salti, that's number two, and I saved you, me'avodatam, from their labor. Vega'alti, three, I redeemed you with an outstretched arm. And the fourth one, ve'lakachti etchem li la'am. You know what lakachti means? And I married you. That's what it means. It means, and I took you, means I married you. What the Torah is using here in the language of Pesach is the same language that it uses in Genesis, which is marriage language. It is the coming close of two. Here it is God and the people of Israel. There it started with Adam and Eve. We saw Abraham and Sarah, and we've seen each of these couples with exactly the same language. And I think unless one understands that Lakach means to marry in all of its dimensions, one won't understand what the language means. So you see that basically the marriage ceremony is really composed of two parts. One is Lakach, the other is Lahavi, to take and to bring. In fact, the Jewish marriage ceremony, until the Middle Ages, consisted of two parts. One, lakach. The other one, lahavi. One part was called kiddushin. Kiddushin. Kiddushin is today the first part of the marriage ceremony. That consists of a cup of wine, and of the groom giving the bride a ring. That's kiddushin. That, in fact, is what we read about in this first session. But that's only one half of the wedding ceremony. Today, what we do is we read the ketubah, and then we have the sheva brachot, the second half of the wedding ceremony. In the time of the Talmud, part one of the wedding ceremony took place in, let's say, 2007. It was today in 2017. Part two took place October 17th, 2008. The two parts, Lakach and Lahavi, were two completely separate ceremonies. After ceremony one, they were married and they were not married. She went to her, back to her family's house. He went back to his family's house. They did not live together as husband and wife during that period of time. That's called erusin. Either kiddushin or erusin. Those two words are used for it. They are words that are rabbinic Hebrew, kiddushin or erusin. You'll see the Talmud will comment on this. Kiddushin refers to the first part of the ceremony, what I call lakach, to take. And that was done year one. Second part, what was called chuppah, or what came to be sheva brachot, was done in year two. Until the Middle Ages, that ceremony was separated by a year. If they wanted to part after the first part of the ceremony, they needed a get. And what we read just now is a woman acquires herself in two ways, with a get, or by the death of the husband. Namely, if she wants to achieve the separate status that she had beforehand, only two ways to do it. Once she has been taken into the first part of the ceremony. But they were not married in that they lived separately. Not allowed to have sexual relations. If anyone had sexual relations with this woman, that was considered full-fledged adultery, and the penalty was stoning. The definition of adultery begins to take force at the moment of kiddushin or erusin or lakachat, as I said. Okay? But they separated. And they did not live together as husband and wife. They were not allowed to live together as husband and wife. That persisted until the Middle Ages. Now that's a long time. Middle Ages for us is like yesterday. So there's a ceremony we know product of the early Middle Ages. And the reason that we developed the ceremony that we have is because when the Crusades began, Jewish life became so precarious that the rabbis decided that they couldn't afford to wait a year to complete the ceremony. So they took the two parts of the ceremony and they put it together, and in order to symbolically separate what had been separated by a year, we read the ketubah. That's why we read the ketubah in the middle of the ceremony. Okay? So, in fact, the ceremony has two parts. It used to be done in 2 years, until Middle Ages, when for practical reasons the rabbis created the ceremony that we have until this day, hasn't changed at all, and it still consists of these two rites. Okay? Any questions?
What was the original rationale for the year of separation?
Probably, no rationale was given. I've often assumed that it has to do with it was a way of getting used to a new reality.
Not being together,
correct. It's a different, it's a step one in that reality. And it happens in steps. And realize that marriage was also family-based, much more than it is today. Usually one went to live with someone's parents. That was the case probably until later times. Was until recently in modern times, but things are probably coming back now. Because it's so expensive to buy an apartment. So people are coming back and living with their parents again, which we haven't seen for like 100 years. But it's just, you watch. This may happen to you. I'm exactly right. We hope so. When I think of when I left my family's house, I left to go to college when I was 18. You know when I went back? Never. I never went. I went back to visit. But I left my family's house when I was 18, and I never went back. Probably a lot of you could tell the same story. My children still live in my house. It's a different world that we're living in today. And in a way, we're coming back to some of these ideas that were really the way people lived in times gone by.
I'm struck sitting here thinking about the fact that God makes the male and female animals separately, but with the human, he takes the female from the male. And thinking about the first few marriages that are made and trying to harken back to the story, you could, I think, and the emphasis on making sure that it's a family relationship, the extraordinary measure to that, you perhaps could make the story that, in fact, it's the search for the mate who is made, but then the man is asleep for a while and then needs to find that mate.
That is in the Talmud. That's in the Sefer Yevamot. That is really a fully developed idea that we have in the Talmud. Also exists in other cultures, but that surely comes directly out of, I think it follows from what we've just been saying. It's a beautiful sort of continuation of that story. And keep in mind, I skipped the end of the second chapter of Genesis, which says, Al-Kain, therefore a man leaves his mother and his father and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh. And it's just an extraordinary thing. Really, imagine that in the scriptures that you have, in a way, it's just a sexual. But then the question of whether it is sexual. Because what does one flesh mean? Does one flesh mean sex, or does one flesh mean the child? That, in fact, the man and the woman become one flesh again in the child. So, none of this, of course, is clear in the Hebrew, and that's the richness of it. Hebrew is a language where you live with all these rich possibilities and your mind takes off. And that's exactly the way it has to be. To be continued next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know this.